Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 23, Harry Potter, the Movies, where we will be talking with screenwriter Janet Batchelor about translating Harry Potter from page to screen. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I'm your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Today, my co-pilot is Kat Sass. Last seen on our Marauders episode, Kat has a master's degree in language and literature. She blogs and podcasts on fantasy and sci-fi literature, film, and television, and she works at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for being my co-host for today's episode, Kat.
Thank you so much for having me back, Katie.
I'm excited for us to get a chance to talk about the films, and I think this is something that listeners are going to be really interested in, too, so I think we'll have a great conversation. And our special guest today is Janet Batchelor, a screenwriter whose credits include Pompeii and Batman Forever. She has been teaching for the USC School of Cinematic Arts since 2007, Professor Batchelor's fall course on screenwriting at the University of Southern California was just written up in the LA Times. That course was called The Harry Potter Franchise, Adaptation, Ethics, Genre, and the Magic of Story. The magic of story is definitely what we are all about on this podcast, and so I'm really excited to hear all about this class. Welcome to the show, Janet.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us today is Elizabeth Baird Hardy, Senior Instructor of Literature at Mayland Community College and author of Milton, Spencer, and the Chronicles of Narnia. She was last seen on our Crimes of Grindelwald show, and I'm excited to hear what she thinks about the Harry Potter films. Welcome back, Elizabeth.
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm so excited. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I know, you know, that we've got this world of, you know, Fantastic Beasts where we're all thinking about those films, but I think it's really important for us to kind of look at the Harry Potter films, which I think are in a bit of a different universe coming from the novels as they are. So I'm excited to really get into this discussion today. So Janet, tell us, when did you first realize that the Harry Potter books and movies were worthy of serious investigation?
Well, I realized that the books were worth taking seriously very early on. I read the first three books over the Y2K weekend of January 1st, 2000.
Waiting for the apocalypse.
Well, we were pretty sure the apocalypse wasn't happening at that point. And I was captivated. And I think it was after book four that I began to get involved with online discussions, book groups. There were Harry Potter for grown-ups, some of those online discussions that were happening, and taking them very, very seriously. And the movies, of course, are an extension of the books. They're an extension of the world. And as a screenwriter, I have to take them seriously in terms of looking at how were the adaptations handled? What did they get right? What could have been done a little bit better? So from my point of view professionally, I've always taken them seriously.
I imagine that's an occupational hazard for you when you're going to the movies. You're always kind of thinking that way.
Unfortunately, that's true. I look forward to the movies that pull me in so completely that the part of my brain that's always analyzing just turns off and goes with the story.
Yeah, definitely. So what made you decide to focus on the Harry Potter movies for your film adaptation screenwriters class at USC?
That was actually a decision that was made by my department. We have a class that repeats every semester called Screenwriters and Their Work. And it's a class that's open to anybody in the university. It's not a general education class, but just an elective for anybody in the university taught by the writing division in the School of Cinematic Arts. And many, many different topics have been covered. They've covered the works of John Hughes, and they've covered film noir, and they've covered superhero movies. And this semester, they're doing LGBTQ movies. So the decision to do Harry Potter was made by the people who run my department, and they came to me to say, would you like to teach this class? It took me about half a second to say yes. And I spent that half a second going, oh my goodness, I can't believe they're asking me to do this.
Yeah, so what do you think makes them good for students to study in this context? You know, what is it about the films that, you know, that students can get something out of?
Well, I think different students are going to get different things out of them. About a quarter to a third of my students in this class were film students. They are majoring in one aspect of film or another. So for them, of course, the issues of how do you make the choices, the myriad of choices that have to be made in adapting a book series this extensive, those were very practical, technical issues that we tried to deal with. And we looked at the screenplays, we looked at the movies from a technical point of view and talked about what can we learn about writing from these movies. I kept a running list of writing tips for the students. Many of the other students, I think, you know, were just excited to take a college class about Harry Potter. Who would not want to take that class?
Oh, yeah. No way. Sign me up. Absolutely. It sounded like it was a really popular class. How many students did you get? And you could rate the enthusiasm level there.
We had 260 students, and I expect, which is enormous. It is by far the largest class the writing division has ever had.
Oh, wow.
They moved us from one auditorium to another to keep adding more students as the enrollment kept topping out the rooms that we were in. And we ended up in the largest, sort of most elaborate, you know, worthy of Hollywood premieres theaters on the campus. Which was a lot of fun to be in that room. I got a sense of how excited the students were on the first night. I'm looking at this vast room, theater, packed with students, and I got up and introduced myself, you know, just to make sure they're all in the right place. I said, you know, this is CTWR 431, the Harry Potter franchise, and the room broke out in cheers. And I thought, that's unexpected especially for a night class. This was an evening class. You know, so people are staying up, you know, till 10 o'clock in this class. And then I introduced myself. I said, I'm Janet Batchelor. I'm the professor of this class, and I'm a Ravenclaw. And the room went absolutely berserk.
Yay, Ravenclaw!
So I was 10 seconds in, and I already knew this is going to be a very good class.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, I don't get that in World Civ.
No, I'm
I don't
sure.
get that in Freshman Comp either.
Yeah. I don't get that in any of my screenwriting workshop classes either.
And so. you might hope for that reaction by the end of the class, but it's amazing to start a class with the tears and the excitement and anticipation and appreciation of what they're going to be learning, not even what they've learned, but just...
Yes, it was a unique experience. I want to sort of hold on to it because I'm not sure I'll get it again walking into a classroom.
Do you think these are traditional age students or a lot of them, older students? Sometimes with our night classes we get.
Oh, no. These were almost all undergraduate students. I had a handful of graduate students, most of them from the film school, but 95% or more were undergraduate students. So this was the generation that, in fact, grew up with the books. So the oldest of these students is 22. You know, the first few books came out before they could read or as they were just learning to read, but this is really the last generation to wait for the books to come out and then wait for the movies to come out. These are the kids who, as kids, went to the midnight release parties and sat down on the curb and started reading. So this is a generation, and they're very aware. that they are the last generation to have the really special moment of waiting for the books, what John Granger calls the interlibrum period. Mm-hmm. And they are very aware that their younger siblings have all the books available to them at once and all the movies available to them at once and could just binge them. And so it was special to sort of teach really the last generation to have that experience.
And did you find that most of them, I saw that you actually do have them in the course reading at least one of the books so that you've got the idea of the book and it's not just the movies. But did you find that they were all readers of the books anyway?
I was surprised at the number that were not. Mm. I would say maybe 10 to 15% of the students had never read the books. Oh. This was only a 2-unit class. This was not a high demand class. We didn't feel that we could ask them to sit down and read thousands of pages. Uh-huh. For this particular class, but we wanted to make sure that everybody had at least read one book. And again, I was surprised at the number who had seen the movies but not read the books.
Very interesting. They tended to see the films, though. I mean, Kat was telling us on the Marauders episode, Kat, you were telling us that you actually saw the films first and then read the books when you were intrigued from the films.
Well, the first three films. So
right.
I kind of caught up between the third. I caught up with the books between the third and the fourth movie. So, and then I had to wait for the final two books. So there was some back and forth there.
I just imagine it's a little different when you've seen the movie already and then you go back and you read the book. It would maybe influence the way you see the characters or the world. What do you think, Kat?
Well, I think that might depend on the person a little bit. I'm not somebody who, when I read a book, either having seen a film or not, visualizes certain things like facial features very strongly, whereas I know that there are people who do that and who find maybe seeing an actor in a movie distracting, either because it does or doesn't match this sort of internal idea that you've had. Mm-hmm. Some of those details, I personally tend to hold the novel in my head and the film that's on screen in slightly different categories, which I think is partly why I'm sort of maybe okay with certain adaptational choices that a lot of people might have more difficulty with. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a very personal thing, and it maybe has something to do with how you process images and how you read things and how strongly do you visualize. But probably things more like the world, the scenery, the you know, the shooting locations, the idea of what the places look like, I'm sure must have informed my reading of those first few books, probably more than I even realized that they did.
Yeah, you know, I remember, this is from a very long time ago now, but I remember Roger Ebert reviewing the very first movie, and one of the things he said was, like, the Gryffindor common room looks exactly like we all thought the Gryffindor common room looks. And that's kind of a weird thing, you know, when even, I think, just to respond to your point, Kat, I think even some of us who had a very clear idea saw that almost perfectly replicated. Mm-hmm. I know that's not true for everybody, but I mean, I don't know if it's something to do with Rowling's ability to describe a scene or, you know, the people who were writing it, filming it, making the sets, being able to really translate that well. So Janet, when you are looking at the films, especially in the context of this class, but just thinking about them in general, do you think of them as distinct artistic products, or are you always thinking of them as extensions of the book or representations that are supposed to be tied closely to the novels?
Oh, I think they're absolutely tied to the novels. I think a lot of effort was made to be as faithful to the books as possible. Mm-hmm. As the books got longer and longer, of course, the movies didn't have that option. So the choices that had to be made in adapting the books become more and more difficult, more and more complex. But yeah, I think of them as a separate thing than the books. Nobody has touched the books. The books are still there to be read in full by anybody. The movies do not change the books at all. And I feel very confident, given the enduring popularity of this series, that somewhere down the line, another visual version of the Harry Potter saga will be made. possibly for TV, possibly for the big screen again, but I feel very confident that we will see further interpretations of the story, and this will not be the definitive one. So for me, I guess I felt like I didn't feel as if changes that the movies made harmed the books, because the books were still there and still very, very available.
Janet, I just had this exact argument with I'm very connected to the Tolkien fandom, and we are girding ourselves for the impending Tolkien biopic and the Amazon Prime series, which is in the works. And I said the exact same thing. A friend of mine said that he didn't want to see another one of his childhood heroes mangled. And essentially, I kind of said, you know, they can't mangle him. He is what he is. He wrote what he wrote. Nothing they can do, for better or worse, I think, can change the original stories. They'll always sort of be there to go back to. And I'm sort of interested in what they do with it. Whether I end up liking it or not, I'm sort of professionally interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, I am too. I have to confess to not being a fan of the Lord of the Rings movies, because I thought they were not faithful to the books in a few very specific ways that disappointed me greatly.
Sure.
So I didn't like what they did with Faramir. I didn't like what they did with the sword that was broken. So I'm not a fan of those movies, where the Harry Potter movies, I think, really tried very hard. They worked so hard to be faithful. Joe Rowling was involved in the decision-making all along through the process. And the changes that were made, I see as an inevitable outcome of adapting a book to a movie. There will be changes. Not everybody will like every change. I agree with many of the changes that were made. And honestly, through this class, I had the opportunity to say, well, what else could the filmmakers have done? And in cases where I was like, well, I'm not sure that was the best choice, realizing that really they did make the best choice in certain areas, that given the time constraints that they had, in many ways, they made very smart choices in their adaptation, and that they stayed faithful to the characters and the story and the themes of the books. So, you know, I am by and large happy, and I know that that doesn't always happen. So I think they should be commended for doing as good a job as they did.
I love what you said there about how, you know, when you it's easy to complain, but then if you've got to try to figure out a better route through the material, you know, that doesn't add 7 hours onto the film, and you might actually realize, oh, I guess maybe they didn't really have the ability to change that. So, Elizabeth, let's get your thoughts on this, you know, in terms of the films. You know, what do you think about them? Do you feel like they're their own thing? Do you worry that they're not close enough to the books? What are your ideas?
Well, I do also like that idea that they're not. It's not that you can damage the books by seeing the movies. The books are still what they are, and they still exist on their own. They're their own, and I love that we pointed that out. And there are some things that the movies do very well. You know, as we think about. And there's some things that you can't do in a book, which is interesting. I was just thinking about some of the things that really come across so beautifully in the films. And I think the thing that I love the most, when I always come back to, is the scene where Hermione obliviates her parents.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in a movie. Not just a Harry Potter movie, any movie. That was unreal. Gosh, we haven't even opened the M&Ms yet. And we're all crying.
I've read this book 10 times. Kind of a throwaway line. It's a throwaway line kind of in the book itself. But
I
love
nothing.
That.
It's just a nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you
there's such a weight to that. Yeah, I was going to say, you can't do that in a book. We can't have, because it's even though it's, you know, Hermione, of course, is integral to the story. We're focused on Harry, so we don't go home with Hermione. We don't know about her relationship with her parents. We never see that. And yet in a film, because we're doing it visually, in 30 seconds, and that we can see her whole experience, and just it just deepens her character so beautifully. And then there are some things that don't work so well. In a book, when you get to the end of a book, you know, I can go back and read this again. Isn't this wonderful? And one of the things that I've always had problems with the films, which, you know, it's just sort of a mixed bag, some things I really love, and
but the endings always fall flat for me of all the films. I always felt like the endings are just like, yeah, okay. You know, the first one less so than the others, but then many of them, because I think those endings, because it really isn't, as James Thomas says, this isn't seven books. This is one book, and it is 4,100 pages long. So it's not, you're not really ending when you get to the end of the books anyway. We're going on. But with a film, we expect sort of a bow on the package. And it's really hard to do that with those stories. So there are some things that just by the nature of the medium that a film can do so much better. And that scene with Hermione and her folks is one of those things. And then just some of the great facial expressions and some of those moments. And like you're saying, about the things that really capture it beautifully for you. There are some places, the Honeydukes of the films is the Honeydukes of my mind. And so those are some things that the films really do beautifully. And they are, but they are a separate medium. So you have to understand them, just like you can't say, you can't compare a steak to an apple pie. You can like them both. You can have both of them and say they're both fabulous. You don't have to say that one's better than the other. They're different creatures. Well, hopefully they're not creatures. Hopefully they're a steak and an apple pie.
Yeah, and I think that's a great question, Elizabeth, in terms of what the filmmakers can do that because of the medium in which they're working compared to the novels.
Well, the filmmakers, of course, what the big difference between novels and films is that novels give you access to the inside thoughts of a character. Right. In a movie, we do not have access to what a character is thinking. We just don't. However, the Harry Potter novels are written third-person limited omniscience, which means that we get to understand what people are thinking, except it's limited to just Harry. We really only understand what Harry's thinking. We don't go inside anybody else's mind.
Except he's inside Voldemort's head. Then we get that.
Right.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
That's still through Harry. So we don't have that available to us in a movie. A screenwriter, filmmaker doesn't have available the ability to step inside the mind of Harry Potter. However, because we have actors on the screen, what we do get sort of in return is the ability to maybe understand some of the other characters whom we didn't understand quite as well because we have real live people playing them and the nuances of, say, Professor McGonagall responding to Dolores Umbridge are just so utterly delicious in a way that perhaps they can't be in the book when we don't have access to that character's mind because of the choices the author has made.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I was thinking, Elizabeth, the scene that you mentioned where Hermione obliviates her parents, you know, and they're not saying anything. It's really a good illustration, Janet, of what you're talking about, that we're just watching the expressions, and that itself is telling us so much. Another thing, and Elizabeth, that was something that I put this out on social media to see what the people who listen to the podcast liked about the changes and didn't like about the changes, and one of the things they liked, that obliviate moment, was one of them. Uh-huh. And another one that a few people said was the Slughorn story about Lily's charm, you know, with the little fishbowl.
And the fish. Yes.
Francis.
Yes.
Francis, yes.
Yeah, and that's
a wonderful story. That whole sequence really jumps out to me in a way I don't think that it did in reading it. You know, Aragog's funeral, but there's, you know, that wouldn't be, if you asked me, my top 50 Harry Potter moments. I don't think I would have said that reading, you know, about Aragog's funeral was one that I found particularly touching. But there's something about the sensitivity of Jim Broadbent's performance and then the music and the beauty of the scenery and Hagrid's sad. And there's something kind of silly about it too. The fact that we're having this whole, you know, funeral for this giant spider and the way that that then feeds into the, you know, much more powerful scenes about, you know, Lily and Slughorn's memories and everything. Like, that's something where you're using the power of the medium to make a scene work in a way that I don't even think it really did on the page.
Well, it also gives us, it's a great example, it also gives us an opportunity to see that scene from a different perspective, because when we experience that scene in the books, we are with Harry, hyped up on Felix Felicis, and all he's thinking about is getting the memory from Slughorn. So we are not viewing the entire funeral of Aragog from any sort of objective point of view. We're viewing it only through Harry's eyes, his goals at the moment, and the film allows us to sort of step back and see it from a point of view we didn't get to see it from in the books.
It's a really good point to think about when a scene is added like that. If it's a scene that adds to that sort of emotional heft into the deeper meaning, I think those are the ones that work because they do that, because they are deepening the story. When we feel like something is added, I've often complained about Prisoner of Azkaban that really I didn't need to see the Whomping Willow kill birds once, much less as many times as we saw it happen. And with all the time that took, we could have gotten more of the Marauder's backstory that would have really added more to the, which is really important in terms of the heft of the story. So I think if it's just play, if we're just using the medium for cheap thrills, which to me, and a lot of people love that sequence, thought it was funny. I thought it was a cheap thrill. So if we're just using the movie for a cheap thrill, then it doesn't, you know, have that kind of payoff. But when we add to that emotional depth, and we do take that, because we do have that third person omniscient, John Granger always describes it as being the house elf sitting on Harry's shoulder with the camcorder and recording everything that goes on. I love that image. It's really funny. And then occasionally he sticks it inside Harry's ear, so you know what's going on inside Harry's head. But when we don't have that perspective, we can go beyond that, and when it deepens the experience and it adds that value to it, it really is beautiful. It really works so well.
That's an interesting example, because I would put in that category from the same movie, the Whomping Willow sort of action sequence where the tree attacks them and they're kind of grabbing on and being thrown all around. And that's one where I feel like, you know, there's a good 2 minutes there that I could live without, honestly. The birds example, one thing I do like is the way that that movie uses the Whomping Willow to show the passage of time, and the way that that kind of feeds into the symbolism of the time turner and seasons changing and, you know, time and growing up and all those sorts of things. So, I mean, I won't tell you not to be offended by the killing of birds, but like, I do enjoy the kind of seasonal check-in with the Whomping Willow and the way that that kind of, for me, that does pay off like a larger theme in the story. But I totally understand what you mean in the point that you're making.
Here's another one.
It does work with the clock. I love the clock in it.
Yeah, I know. I love all the clock imagery. But here's another one that one of our producers for the show, Lori Beckoff, Harry Potter super fan, she talked about in The Order of the Phoenix, the scene where Voldemort does the kind of possession of Harry, and that's much longer in the movie than it is in the book. And actually in the scene that precedes that with the battle between Dumbledore and Voldemort in the Ministry of Magic, I remember I watched that movie with my husband, and he's like, the whole movie should have been that. You know, it sort of tells you his movie preferences. But, you know, because that was a really cool thing that you can't see just when you're reading the book, but how neat to be able to see all the visual effects as Dumbledore and Voldemort, the two greatest wizards, you know, of that time, are facing off against each other. I did think a lot of that was really cool use of the visual medium.
It absolutely was. And we talked to the screenwriter of Order of the Phoenix about that sequence.
Oh.
And one of the things, for instance, after the designers have done their work, because we get a lot about the design of Hogwarts, the look of Hogwarts from the books. We don't get nearly as much about the Ministry of Magic. Mm-hmm. And the designers came in and created this sort of black marble look, and all the windows, all those interior windows. And at a certain point when they were designing those sequences, they made the decision to shatter all those windows. And, you know, those little tiny moments, somebody's going to work, a whole team of people are going to work a month to make a few seconds They're going to work actually several months to make a few seconds of screen time really work. So I thought that they made a lot of really good visual choices that were not handed to them by the books. Mm-hmm. And they also are dealing with one of the most difficult things, which is the possession sequences. Yes. The moments when Voldemort is taking over Harry's thoughts, because we don't have access to Harry's thoughts. That's something we can't do. We can't think with him in a movie. It's not possible. So now, each time you do it, you have to think, how am I going to visualize this? How am I going to do it so an audience understands it without Harry standing there saying, why, I do believe that Voldemort is in my mind right now. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do. So I think that may be one of the reasons that that sequence was more extended than in the books, because, you know, you don't have the luxury of grabbing a hold of Harry's thoughts and getting it. You have to find a way to make it visual.
Yeah, that's really neat. And so you were able to bring in, as a guest speaker to your class, people who'd worked on that film who could talk about the visual effects?
We didn't. The problem is that the film was shot in England, and a university budget does not really allow for flying many, many people over from England. So we did get to have a few guests. We would have loved to have had more, but we were by and large limited to people who were available to us in Los Angeles.
Sure, sure. Still, in Los Angeles, you got much more possibility than like I do here in little Marietta, Ohio.
That's probably true.
Yes, we're in Western North Carolina, right. So yeah, right. We don't get a lot of that. Although I did have some students who were extras in the Hunger Games, so it was kind of cool.
Nice. Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Well, and the Hunger Games is set in the sort of Appalachian, Ohio, West Virginia yeah. area that I live in. So a little connection there, Elizabeth.
There you go.
So one of the other characters who I think, Janet, you were talking about getting a chance to see things from another character's point of view as one of the benefits of the films. And I think Snape might be an interesting example of this. One of the things that some of our listeners said was that they really liked some of the sequencing of Snape's memories and, you know, this image of when Snape finds Lily and she's been yes. killed by Voldemort and how powerful that is. Oh, and that's one
that,
of those.
That one image.
Yeah.
Oh, that one image.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
And it gives you Snape's perspective in a way that maybe the books are not able to, maybe until just that very last sequence. But even then, I think the movies perhaps do a better job with that.
Oh, absolutely. That's such a powerful, powerful sequence. I think much more emotionally gripping. I think when you read it in the book, you're going, oh, let me put these pieces together to understand who Snape was working for. Whereas in the book, it just grabs your emotions. And, you know, let's give props to Alan Rickman for that. You know, that such an important character. We all know, of course, that he knew the truth, that Jo Rowling pulled him aside and told him who Snape was, the information that an actor needs that even the screenwriter and the director did not have, but he had. So smart of her to do that. And I also want to give props to Chris Columbus, because I think he gets dissed sometimes. People are sort of like, well, the first two movies were children's movies, and the filmmaking got so much better later. And I just want to pause and say, the director casts the movie. Yes. Chris Columbus cast the movie. He gave us Maggie Smith. He gave us Alan Rickman. He gave us the trio. He deserves enormous credit. Plus, he supervised the whole look of the movies. He established what Hogwarts looked like. Working off of the books. So I want to give him the credit he deserves for casting the movies so utterly beautifully.
I don't have any problem with the casting from the first two films. I think it's brilliant. Mm. Any of the casting issues that happened later on that I'm not happy with, they were in the later films. So I think that's wonderful that you pointed that out, because that is kind of setting that, and really, Alan Rickman, just don't make me cry.
Maggie Smith.
It's just unbelievable. That is, yes. Well, she's Maggie, fantastic. She's okay, right? She's okay. I'm not crying over Maggie Smith.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, right. I see what you're saying. Didn't hear anything. Yeah, right. No. I just mean she was also a great casting decision.
Yeah, absolutely. As McGonagall. Yes. Oh, amazing.
Just perfect.
And the as things you said, she can do with her eyebrows.
Jed, it was, as you, I think you were the one who was saying that, you know, when she's talking to Umbridge, and yes. just the things that she can communicate that you don't get just reading something on the page.
Yes.
Fantastic.
She has that look on her face that we have all had on our face in a faculty meeting at some time. That's the look that was on my face. I know. That was the look.
Yeah, and she gets some cool things to do, too, like the thing where she, like, sets the stone soldiers in motion, you know, the Battle of Hogwarts.
Yes.
There were some really cool visual things she was able to do.
Yeah, that little squeal she gives when she gets to use that spell.
I've always wanted to use that spell. Adorable. Yes.
Can I play devil's advocate with Snape a little bit here?
At
the risk of, you know, upsetting the Snape stands, of which there are many. So forgive me for a question that's more of a comment, but I guess I wanted to propose something and you guys can tell me what you think. When Katie put out the call on social media that this episode was going to happen, was asking for examples of changes for, you know, ones that we liked or didn't. The thing that jumped out to me, I just reread and rewatched all the movies right in order over the last few months. And I don't know that I've ever done them that concentrated, both of them, one after the other, right together in that short amount of time. So different things sort of jumped out to me than ever had before. And I feel like if I had to say what is one of the biggest single changes over the course of 8 films, for me, and it's not a single change, it's more of a recalibration. I would have to say that Snape's character is one of them. There are a lot of moments that in, you know, are examples of just the more kind of, I don't know, in quotes, villainous behavior that are very quietly and subtly sort of just removed. It's not necessarily an acting thing per se. So it's not something I'm, you know, laying at Alan Rickman's feet. It's more of a screenwriting decision of the big example, I think, being not having Snape's worst memory be about the relationship with Lily and sort of calling her mudblood and that break in the relationship. But there are a lot of examples like that where they just sort of remove that thing that makes him this character that Harry really hates. And I think that has a very subtle but a very strong influence over the course of the 8 movies. So I kind of wanted to throw that out there and see if that's something that you guys had ever, if it had occurred to you before. Do you think that I'm way off base? Do you think that that's a trend across different characters, perhaps? Wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that.
Well, if I can jump in, something I want to point out is that it wasn't until movie number 5 was already written and shooting that the filmmakers knew how the story was going to end. So there are things that now you would say, oh, what a lovely moment that sets up where Snape is going. And they didn't know that. They didn't know where Snape was going. They weren't privy to the knowledge that Alan Rickman had. They didn't know that tiny little moment might matter. The only time that Joe Rowling stepped in and said, no, you can't cut that, was when they wanted to cut Creature in movie number 5 in Order of the Phoenix. And she said, no, you need to leave Creature in. You're going to need him later. That's the only time. And that was a financial issue because animating the house elves is very expensive, very time consuming. So that would have, it looked at the time like a very easy cut to make. And she stepped in and said, no, you must have creature now. You know, but the all those fine details, they didn't know. She does a magnificent job of setting things up and paying them off. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't know what the payoff is going to be. And so they had setups available to them that they didn't take advantage of because they didn't know that they were setups that were going to have a payoff.
What a challenging situation, Janet, for a screenwriter.
Right.
To
right.
not really know where it's going. And yeah. she can tell Alan Rickman, but she can't yes. tell the people writing the screenplay.
Right.
I think one of the things that you had talked about before was that when you're trying to adapt something from the book to the screen, that in order to know what you can cut, you do kind of have to know what your end result is. Where are you going? And then you're going to try to do all the things that you need. But I'm just thinking about how difficult that must be for the screenwriter who's in the dark on that. Props to them. I think they did a really good job, honestly. And I guess you've got J.K. Rowling there to tell them, keep creature in. You know, Alan Rickman is just such a delightful actor, and he puts so much personality even into his evil characters, like in Die Hard. I mean, people you kind of love how evil he is. And so, I think, you know, in a way, just, you know, that you have Alan Rickman playing him is going to take some of Snape's edge off. But I do think that's a really interesting point, Kat, about how you've got these, you know, these other little moments that are disappearing, and maybe they don't really seem all that important. You know, Snape is supposed to be the villain because of some other things that are pointing to it, but it does make him a definitely more attractive character. I kind of think Draco might also work that way. You were asking about other possibilities, and I wonder if Draco also comes off a little bit better in the movies. He's given much more emotional life, for example, as he's trying to kill Dumbledore. We feel a lot of pity for
yes.
him in the
yes.
movie.
Sure. And is that to Janet's point about when you have an actor, just the fact of seeing the face of the person going through what they're going through, there's something humanizing about that in a way that Harry doesn't necessarily have a lot of empathy for Draco in that moment, so we're not getting it communicated to us as strongly.
Yeah.
We also know what Draco is up to, and Harry doesn't.
Right, right.
Because since we can break away from Harry's point of view, we're able to go into the Room of Requirement and see him trying and failing, and we can try and figure it out for ourselves. It's new information to us, even if we're familiar with the books. We don't really know what he was doing, and so it becomes very interesting to sort of go on that little mini journey with Draco.
And we get all that great stuff with the birds and just like the clocks in the and even though I have a lot of complaints about Azkaban, the clock business I love, but all that bird imagery, because of course Dumbledore and his association with the Phoenix, this is the movie where we lose Dumbledore. So of course we need bird symbolism.
So and you're okay
how can
with
we build
the dead
that
birds
in?
There's a lot of bird death in these movies.
I know, I'm realizing
birds.
That.
Yes. Yes, and there are birds. I'm clearly a bird person, if you haven't noticed. I really love birds. But no, the idea that we can do that with, and I mean, Draco could have been using anything. He could have been using, ferrets would have been appropriate, considering his emotional right. issues there. He probably had to have therapy about ferrets for years. But by using the bird, you know, and that twittering sound, you know, that is just, and again, it's like that obliviating scene. It is so much done with no dialogue. And part of that, again, is he is so engaging. He does such a good job with that part that adds a lot to it as well. Just like Alan Rickman, you know, you have this character. I would be interested to know if people who only saw the films, how soon they cottoned on to what was really happening, as opposed to people who only read the book. At what point did you start figuring things out? Because before the last book came out, we had all those, you know, trust Snape, no, Snape's a bad guy kind of campaigns going on, you know, are you team Snape or not sort of thing. And I wonder what the difference would be for film-only people versus book-only people, at what point they figured it out. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it probably has to do with the faces we're seeing when we make those decisions.
I think it may be. I remember when the movies were just starting to come out, my kids were still young, I'm driving carpool, and I'd be listening to conversations about the movies, like the first one or two movies, between kids who knew the books inside out and kids who'd never read the books. And the kids who'd never read the books weren't following the movies. Mm-hmm. They just weren't. You know, and they were young, but they needed things explained to them. And the kids who'd read the books were happy to explain left and right what was really happening. And the conversations always ended up with, you have to read the books.
Well, I've wondered about that too, because you do see them leaving out a lot of things and you think, you know, are people going to understand that? And I did actually have the misfortune of watching one of the movies sitting in front of a couple who the guy had never encountered the books and the woman knew all about it. And she was constantly filling in all of the things. Oh, see, that's Bella. And the thing you need to know about Bella, you know, Bella. Is
right.
So I guess, I mean, yeah, Bellatrix and all this right, kind of stuff.
And I had a similar experience. I said that in the Marauders episode with Prisoner of Azkaban, that I love that movie, but because it failed in some ways, it drove me to the books because I was enjoying what I was seeing, but not understanding how it all tied together. And my friends were kind of explaining, like, well, these people grew up together. They knew each other. They're the animals. They wrote the map. And I was like, I have to go read this book. So even the fact that maybe sometimes they don't fully do justice to all of the narrative strands, I think while that might be a failure of cinematic storytelling, in a way it serves as an advertisement for the book that, you know, there is this really satisfying text that you can go read that explains everything in detail.
Especially with the very long books, I think particularly of Order of the Phoenix, my attitude is that the movie is really a trailer for the book.
And isn't it the shortest of the movies, but the longest of the books? Is that
it is? So right? There's some very efficient storytelling going on there. Yeah,
it's ruthlessly efficient. And I know David Yates sometimes gets like slammed for his overuse of montage, but there are, and I think it does get a bit much in after several movies of it. But I felt like that was a really economical way to get through certain sections of Order of the Phoenix, like Umbridge's sort of Reign of Terror, where you just have you're covering hundreds of pages in 5 minutes, where we're just getting little vignettes and snippets of all of her micromanaging of every little thing. I thought that actually worked really well in that movie.
Yeah, you know, one of our former guests on the podcast, Brett Fish, studies the detective aspects of the books, particularly, and his comment to this question about changes that you liked or didn't like, he actually thought Half-Blood Prince, and especially he mentioned Elizabeth the Birds and the use of the birds. He said that movie actually does a much better job with the detective plot than any of the other movies does. That I was thinking about what Janet, you said about how the movies, you know, they're able to be emotionally very rich, but sometimes they, you know, they're engaging your emotions and not necessarily the, you know, the intellectual reasoning part, or the books are doing more of that. And he said he thought Half-Blood Prince actually was the best at maybe laying down some of the lines of the detective plot in it in a way that the books didn't, you know, that was actually a little bit more thoughtful than the books.
Well, Half-Blood Prince is a deceptively difficult book to adapt because, first, nothing happens until the very end. They sit and talk. That's a problem for a movie. It's a big problem for a movie. It's fine for a book. I loved Half-Blood Prince, but in a movie, that's a problem. Anything that happens, all they're doing, they're going back in time and observing. Well, observing is inherently non-cinematic. Flashbacks are problematic in movies. You can't have too many of them because movies have forward momentum and a flashback stops that forward momentum. So it's really everything that you want out of a movie adaptation isn't present in Half-Blood Prince. And yet you have to make the movie. And the filmmakers, I think, chose very smartly to focus on the relationships and make this the teenage romance movie as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Because, in part because they knew they were about to turn the corner into Deathly Hallows. And of course, the corner turns the moment that Dumbledore says we're going to the cave. That's the moment we've turned a corner and it's about to get unremittingly dark for many, many hours of screen time going forward. So this movie was deliberately a little lighter. They had to find something to keep the movie propelling itself forward rather than let's discuss the nature of Horcruxes. Let's discuss what we just saw in the Pensieve. Lots of scenes of sitting and talking, which is really problematic for a movie.
Yeah, I liked all the romance. I'm a romantic, but I'm their target audience. But I also really liked the humor that they brought in. I think all the books have a humorous quality to them, and I thought Half-Blood Prince did a really good job of bringing that in, even in some things that were like, isn't that the one where Harry says, "I am the chosen one"? that's Half-Blood Prince, isn't it? Right? Yeah. And I just think I think that's hilarious. And actually, what somebody did put that little "I am the chosen one" on our social media as a little thing. That's kind of, it's just delightful in a way that I think suits the tone of the books, even though it's not in there.
Right.
So I like that. I like that one. Now, listeners also hated things that were changed, and one of the big ones that people mentioned was the burrow burning down.
We discussed that in my class.
Yeah. Oh yeah, okay. What did you all talk about in the class about why they did that and how we should understand that inclusion?
Well, you know, we are in the middle of a movie that has nothing happening. Ultimately, I think that is at the heart of the decision making made at that point. Nothing is happening in this movie. People are falling in and out of love, and we're trying to figure out a very difficult puzzle that we don't have the pieces to. So I felt the burning of the burrow personally. I felt it was unmotivated because these are wizards. Why don't they put out the fire?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why don't they fight back? Why doesn't Bellatrix kill Harry? How come the Death Eaters were able to get through the protections that were surrounding the burrow? Why in Deathly Hallows is the burrow suddenly again a safe place for Harry to be?
That's
because
the big
it just
one.
Wasn't a safe place for Harry to be. They added that felt to me like a studio saying we need a little more action. And by the way, think of how much money we're spending on Helena Bonham Carter.
Let's give her something to do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they added that sequence right in the middle of the movie. That is at the midpoint of the movie. The midpoint of the movie is where you want to raise the stakes. You want to say, oh, things are life and death. Things are getting serious now. Well, you know what? In the book, nothing is getting serious. We're all just sitting and talking. We don't have something to draw from in the book to say, oh, let's get serious again. Things are getting dangerous. Nothing is happening. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a sense of jeopardy from the outside. All they had was a lot of romance and a lot of theoretical discussion about what Horcruxes are. They wanted to add a more experiential sequence. The issue here is, you know, we talk about stories in terms of the A story, the B story, the C story, often in screenwriting. The A story here is solving the mystery of the Horcruxes. Is Voldemort making Horcruxes? What are the Horcruxes? How can we find the Horcruxes? But until we head to the cave, all we're doing is having theoretical scholarly discussions and maybe doing a little research. Yes, it's nice if we can use the Pensieve for some of that research, but it's a movie about research. That's a pretty tedious A story to try and put on film, as fascinating as it may be to read. And I'm a mystery fan. I'm an Agatha Christie fan. I am perfectly happy with reading books that are all about sitting down and figuring out clues, harder to do on screen. The B stories are all the romances It's Ron and Hermione, or Ron and Lavender, or Hermione and Cormac, or Harry and Gin, or Romilda Vane. You know, you have all of that intrigue going on. That's the B story. The C story is Draco and the Vanishing Cabinet. And that's a story that sort of barely existed in the book. But none of those are giving us great experiences. None of those are living up to the action levels of the previous five movies. Not even close. So they're sort of stuck. And I have to say, I would sit down to adapt this and I'd say, what is the midpoint going to be? Because we don't have one. We don't have an obvious moment where the stakes are raised, where life and death are coming into question. What are we going to do? Did they make the right choice with the burning of the burrow? I would say probably not. One of the final exam assignments that I offered to my students was to come up with something to replace the burning of the burrow.
Oh.
And they tried.
Ooh, cool.
I don't think anybody came up with anything great. A couple of students had some very strong ideas that would have been worth exploring, but it just sort of showed how difficult it is to come up with the moment that you need cinematically, the moment that you need structurally in your screenplay that isn't in the book, but that yet doesn't violate the story. And I was concerned about some of the violations of the story that that I felt were there in the burning of the burrow sequence.
That's a really good thought experiment. And I think in all the various ways you listed of how it, you know, didn't really work, the one that really jumps out to me is that you said it's fine in the next movie. That, you know, maybe you could kind of justify it if there were consequences for it. But
exactly.
The fact that the sequence as it plays out is a little bizarre. And then to kind of make matters worse, it's basically undone, which I think is very telling of the fact that it wasn't something that the filmmakers were necessarily very invested in as an idea in itself.
Yeah, it feels like we've raised the stakes here, but it's a faux raising of the stakes because nothing happens as a result of it.
Right.
Did any of your students suggest making that scene a dream?
I don't believe they did.
Because that seems like the way that you can, you know, but people feel like that's a cheap shot too. And like, oh yeah,
it usually is.
It's usually a cheap shot in a film when that sort of thing happens. But that's, and I, for a while, when I watched, is this a dream? Is this, you know, because I know it doesn't happen in the book. Right. And, you know, how are they going to get back to the way that we need things to be at the, in the next book? So I wonder if that was, that seems like a way that maybe you could hedge your bets, but then people are going to, you know, no matter what, they're going to face criticism, no matter what decision you make there with that sequence.
Another one that I think fans pretty widely dislike is the duel between Harry and Voldemort at the end, where, you know, they're kind of falling off the, you know, off the ledge together.
It goes on forever.
They're wrestling, and then Harry doesn't say Expelliarmus, and then Voldemort, instead of just being, like, literally just a dead man, he has the, you know, this, what is a very cool visual of just flying apart into ash, but that's, it's too spectacular, and that it seemed, people feel as though he was really supposed to die in a very, you know, very banal but unattractive way, as just this thump. So I'm curious if you talked about that in your class, Janet, or if you have any thoughts about, you know, why they took the route they did on the final duel.
I'm not really sure why they did that. For me, the part that I missed was having this duel be witnessed by essentially the entire wizarding community that we know. Mm-hmm. That's what I felt was missing for me. I understand they wanted a mano a mano battle between the hero and the villain. I wanted witnesses. I liked seeing the effects of Nagini's death on Voldemort, that in essence doesn't have enough soul left to fight Harry. I liked seeing that. But I would have loved to have it happen in the Great Hall, you know, as it is in the books, with everybody watching. I just, that's what I missed. that's what I missed. And I could have been happier with the, you know, all through Hogwarts blasting things to bits if we brought it back to the Great Hall and ended it with everybody watching. You know, and everybody hearing Harry call him Tom, that kind of thing. I just felt that the loss of that moment of community.
I think that's really smart, you know, because the importance of that duel being witnessed so widely, and that's all a part of that bringing Voldemort down to Tom size, you know, like you said, the conversation and all that. And I agree with that. I felt like they were, you know, they were going for epic battle scene, and that's not exactly the way it's in the book. It's not a battle scene so much as, you know, I don't know, moral victory in some way. It doesn't translate as well maybe in the film universe. I don't know.
Right.
And is that lack of translation the reason why the Elder Wand is dealt with the way it is well, which is that just, because that just, that's one of those flat endings.
Like, couldn't he just repair his own wand?
Which is what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to repair his own wand. And that just seems like really.
I would have liked to have seen the repairing of the wand. I think the Elder Wand is one of those things that is very complex. After Deathly Hallows, the book came out, one of my colleagues sort of came to me and said, okay, I need you to explain the Elder Wand to me. And they had read the books and couldn't follow it. This is a highly educated man. So it is complicated. And one of the things that we really don't get to do in the movies is have the Dumbledore explains it all to you scene at the end of the movies. We just don't get to sit down and say, we will now walk through everything that happened and explain it to you. We don't get those moments. The Elder Wand sort of demands some of those moments. So I understand why they wanted to simplify that. There might have been a couple of other beats that it would have been nice to include, like Harry repairing his wand.
Now, one of the things I think people kind of worry about in this day and age, and you've sort of addressed this a little bit, but people watching the films, not having contact with the books, and that affects your memory of the books. I know, Kat, when we were talking about the Marauders, you know, we actually brought something up that we thought was in the books, but you pointed out, oh, it's not even in the books, it's just in the movies. And I've had that experience a couple times at conferences where people will say, but what about the scene where, and you say, oh, you know what, that's just in the movie, it's not in the book. How worried should we be that the films are going to eclipse the texts in the popular imagination?
I don't think they're going to. I think the books have such an incredible reach and continue to be read, continue to be loved. I think some people may conflate them in their minds. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I'm not sure that matters to anybody other than the most diehard Harry Potter fans, you know, the people who go to conferences. And I would be concerned about the same thing happening with fan fiction. You know, if mm-hmm. pieces of fan fiction were so well known. In many ways, you can think of the movies as a very, very expensive piece of fan fiction. That's a retelling of the books. But the books are still the heart of the story. The books are what people will turn to. I don't think it's ultimately a problem.
One of the things that you mentioned, and actually Daniel Radcliffe just had speculated about this in an interview too, that there would be a reboot of the Harry Potter story, maybe even as a TV series, but also maybe as a film with different actors. And you sort of suggested, too, that will prevent these movies from being, you said, the definitive version, so that the books still stay the anchor. What do you think, in any kind of future, version of the Harry Potter stories, what do you think would be important, you know, as somebody looks at making this a film anew?
Well, there are several reasons that you make a remake. I mean, look, for instance, you know, the Oscars are tomorrow. as of the time we're recording this, and we're about to see the fourth version of A Star Is Born. And there are reasons for remakes that are good reasons. You know, sometimes you want to see what a different set of actors can bring to a project. To say no, a great movie should never be remade would be like saying we should never have another production of Macbeth again. Sometimes you want to see a different take on a story that you already know. In many cases, effects artists can do grows and multiplies so much that you want to see a story retold to make it come alive in a deeper, richer, more realistic way. That's a wonderful way to do it. I think it would be very interesting, personally, to see a TV series on the Harry Potter stories, or a streaming series that allowed you to go into the fine moments that there weren't time for in the books. Uh-huh. So many moments that we all love that we wish had been on screen, and with more time they could be. I think that would be wonderful to do. As I understand it, it is all in Jo Rowling's lap. What she wants to do with the series is what will happen. So if Dan Radcliffe can sit down with her and say, hey, how about this? Maybe she can start thinking about it. I don't think that's where her thoughts are turning at the moment, as I understand it. So, you know, we will just wait and see. The books aren't going anywhere.
Now, you had an assignment in your course where students got a chance to do their own adaptation of a scene from Harry Potter. And I was just really curious how they turned out. What were some of the best results of that? Did you see anything kind of new and exciting coming out of your students' creativity?
We had several. We performed. We had one day that was devoted to fandom and an exploration of fandom. And we performed four of the scenes.
Oh, fun.
The top scenes as part of that. Had, you know, some of our acting majors come up and take part in it. We used the Obliviate scene, Hermione obliviating her parents, as our example for that, and said, look for a scene that is mentioned in the books but doesn't appear. So don't invent something from whole cloth like the burning of the burrow. Look for something that does exist, but we haven't seen it yet. And I think the two that I liked the best, one was Ron asking Fleur Delacour to the Yule Ball, which was hilarious. So we saw him actually humiliating himself in front of everybody rather than just seeing him be embarrassed about it later. That was a lot of fun.
Yes. Painful, but fun.
And the other one that I thought was quite lovely was we saw many, many, many versions of Christmas on the Closed Ward because, of course, mm-hmm. St. Mungo's wasn't in the movies. So we saw many versions. Many people wrote scenes from that. The one I thought was the most lovely was Neville with his parents, that we went back, you know, behind that curtain at the end of the ward. And we saw Neville visiting with his parents. And he's conjuring up, the student wrote, he's conjuring up snow. And the parents are just watching the snow fall in, you know, and sort of fixated and unable to really communicate with him. And a lot of just quiet moments and his grandmother coming in. And then we pick back up sort of as his grandmother gets ready to leave with him. And he's about to run into Harry. And Harry finds out that his parents are there.
Oh,
it was
my
a
gosh.
Beautiful scene. It was just an absolutely lovely scene. And I went, wait, why did I never think of what Neville was doing with his parents when he visited them? Mm-hmm. I thought that was just lovely.
Oh my gosh, I'm even a little choked up just from your description. And that was one of the things that people felt like they missed from the movies, with some of the, you know, Neville and St. Mungo's, and wow, what a beautiful idea, how to bring that to life.
Yeah. And again, we miss those because at a certain point, you say, I have 2 to 2.5 hours.
Uh-huh.
And what do I absolutely have to have to get to the end of the story? Anything that isn't on that list is subject to being cut.
Yeah, just the reality of the constraints that you're working in. But as
Absolutely.
You said, maybe a TV series would would allow for that. Oh, please, J.K. Rowling, let that happen. I basically, after I saw the first movie, I saw it with my friend Amy Sturgis. We went together, and we both looked at each other, and I was like, it's not like the best movie I ever saw. And there are things that I didn't like about the way that it translated it. But I just want to live in the world of Harry Potter. So as much Harry Potter stuff as can come out, just keep bringing it. I will go see and do all of the things. And so I think that's part of the draw of the fan world. I don't know if you all had that same experience. I think some people got very frustrated with the films. But
I agree. I've been to both of the theme parks. I've been to the Warner Brothers studio tour outside of London. You do just want to immerse yourself.
Yeah.
And I think, I do compare it to Lord of the Rings. I think knowing that J.R.R. Tolkien did not want a movie made of the books, and knowing that Joe Rowling has cooperated fully and has a say in every single thing that happens with her world, makes a difference. She has said yes to everything that Warner Brothers has gone forward with. And to me, it helps to know that nobody is violating the wishes of the author. And that makes it easier for me to enjoy it.
Sure,
And to say, oh, let's buy a wand. I think we should have a wand. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think you've legitimized the things that I want to participate in, so I appreciate that, Janet. You've given me a good thing to say to myself. Well, J.K. Rowling really wants us to experience all these things anyway.
Yes.
Now, I'm noticing that we're beyond our hour here, but let me just ask you one more question, Janet. This has been such a great conversation. The course description for your class, which, by the way, sounds phenomenal, and I can tell just by the way you're talking with us, I can tell you're a phenomenal teacher. What lucky students you have. Your course description says that, like, one of the course objectives is, students are going to determine why the Harry Potter stories are so universal. And this is actually one of the things John Granger talks about a lot, and we talk about on this podcast, that this is the shared text of this generation. There's this universal quality. So, what is the reason? Why do you think this is a universal story? And how are the movie adaptations contributing to that?
I think the movie adaptations contribute to it in that they make it accessible to more people. There are a whole lot of people who, for whatever reasons, are not going to sit down and read, 5,000 pages?
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. And the movies give them a way in. A lot of people now are going to be introduced to the world through the movies or even through the theme park and go back to discover the books. That's one of the things that I think Warner Brothers has actually been very good about, is that things ultimately do point back to the books. That was one of the things we talked about, why we love these books so much. The students sort of jumped in with their own ideas, that it's about growing up. It's about confronting evil in the world.
Uh-huh.
It's about magic. We all want to discover that we are somebody special and that we have a unique and important destiny in the world. And these books get us to live that story through Harry's minds, through his mind and his experiences. There's so much that speaks to the universality of what it means to grow up, of the kinds of choices that you have to make as you grow up. All of that, I think, just catches us in ways that speak to something very deep, even though the first few books are children's books. And so we love them. They help us understand who we are. And we now also can sort of understand other people. In my class, we sorted the class on the first day of class. We had everybody take the sorting hat quiz, the official one, and we sorted the class. And students could win points for their house throughout the semester. So, we had our version of a house cup. And by the way, Slytherin won the house cup.
Did they?
They did.
I thought Ravenclaw always wins those things. Slytherin, huh?
Yes, Slytherin won. Ravenclaw came in second. So, you know, there was a lot of house pride.
Oh!
A lot of house pride.
Slander.
Sorry.
Well, one of the things I loved when I was looking through your syllabus, and I could really tell that your class is not just about the mechanics, but it was deeply about the themes of the books and the meaning that was coming through the books, but also then the films. And connecting those things together, I think, also conveys that sense of, you know, why are we doing this? And it's because it's this way to tell a story that is going to be relatable. It's going to, you know, draw on a huge group of people who are going to be able to see something of themselves in it, or maybe their desires in it as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we talked about some of the major themes, doing what's right versus doing what's easy,
mm-hmm.
you know, come up over and over again in different ways in the books. And they make us think about what choices should we make in our own lives. So I just find the books, each time I reread them, I find the books inspire me one more time.
Me too. And this conversation has been inspiring. I hope, I didn't survey Elizabeth and Kat at the beginning about whether you end up, liking the movies, not liking the movies, but you'll have fans who will be like really determined, like the movies are great or I really hate the movies. But I hope that no matter what side of that our listeners are on, that they have come to a new appreciation of, first of all, how hard it was to translate these books onto the screen, and also that the movies are doing something really important and valuable and, you know, artistically interesting. I think our conversation was really great for that.
Well, it's a pleasure to be part of it.
Well, thank you so much, Janet Batchelor, for being on our podcast today.
My pleasure.
This Insider's View was so eye-opening. And like I said, I can just tell you're a great, great teacher in front of the classroom. How wonderful to learn at your feet.
Well, thank you.
Thanks also to Elizabeth Baird Hardy. Thanks for joining us today, Elizabeth.
Oh, it was a treat. It was so much fun. It was great to meet you, Janet.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
It was terrific. It's always fun to talk with Kat and with Katie. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks. And Kat, you too. I really appreciate you sort of taking my wing woman role and being my co-host on the podcast today. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Happy to do it.
I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Although Emma is, not talking on the show, she wrote the lyrics for our opening song, and she always does a fantastic job editing our podcast for us. Thank you for everything you're doing, Emma. As always, we also appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and our MuggleNet producers, Lori Beckoff and Ruchi Akula. Speaking of which, dear listeners, we are also glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And a special thank you to everyone who answered our posts asking about your favorite and least favorite changes to the stories from the films. I think that made a really good contribution to our episode today. And now, listeners, I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, when we'll be using our words to make some magic.